Welcome to Gin and Topic. We have tasted the gin and now we get on to our topic. Hey, Anya.
Hello, Sarah. It's Friday and we're about to learn something and drink some gin.
We are. What could get better than that?
Honestly, I don't know because we've been doing this for 6 series, so clearly we enjoy it.
And hopefully others do too. So, drink and let's learn.
Let's learn. See you in a minute. Series 6. Who would have thought we'd still be here?
I know.
People still want to speak to us.
But the problem is, there are too many gins in the world.
Too many gins.
And there are too many topics.
And too many people who somehow seem to think having a chat with us sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, whilst drinking gin.
Oh, I mean, it's a hard life.
I mean, who wouldn't think it was a good idea, really?
Me, when you first pitched the idea.
I think it's a good idea. I love talking about random stuff whilst drinking gin. It's perfect.
Yeah, it's what we do every Friday. Only this time we're putting it out on the internet for people to hear us.
So series 6, we have got a lineup of, bizarrely, many ocean-based topics.
Ooh,
this series.
Okay.
Well, you know, a few that could be sort of linked together. We've got plankton. We've got algae.
Methane.
Got methane. We've got some swamp methane, to be
Yeah, but
more
haven't
precise.
We also got sex in space?
Yeah, we got sex in space. Whoop, whoop. And we've also got, like, children's health and the environment. And we've got flying squirrels.
Okay, flying squirrels don't say ocean to me, but I love the idea.
No, exactly. We had ocean. And we do have a few other ones that move away from the ocean.
Realistically, we just got a whole bunch of topics and a whole bunch of gin.
Yeah. Do you know? It is.
It's almost like that's what it says on the tin. Welcome to Gin and Topic.
Cheers. Cheers. So series 6, here we are, starting again with some topics. This one's a good one to start with.
Oh, you've got that look on your face. I'm excited.
So our first topic for series 6 is...
Drum roll!
Sex in space.
I love the way you announce that like you're an extra in sex education. Brilliant.
No, because every time I think of the Muppets and Pigs in Space. but it's not the Muppets and Pigs in Space.
It's sex in space. Is this going to be another one of those topics where we go, we should be more uncomfortable talking about this?
I don't know. Mm. So we're going to be talking with David Cullen, who is a professor of astrobiology and space biotechnology.
I need to get this out of the way. Professor Cullen, as in Twilight, as in I'm going to try not to make a joke about him being a vampire this whole time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the Cullens. Oh, that was their name, Sarah.
I didn't even twig with that one.
Oh, uncultured swine.
Oh, well, the vampires having sex in space.
Well, that didn't famously go well for Bella, did it? That was a major plot point. The Mormon who wrote it really said, don't have sex, you will get pregnant and die.
And don't have sex in space.
Well, let's find out.
So we're talking to David Cullen, Professor of Astrobiology and Space Biotechnology. Mm-hmm. And he is in the space group at the Center for Autonomous and Cyber Physical Systems at the School of Aerospace Transport and Manufacturing at Cranfield University.
Bloody hell, that's a lot of words.
It is, isn't it? It's like one of those addresses that just keeps going with more and more levels to it.
I mean, it's very impressive.
It is. We are talking sex in space and our question.
Yes.
Is the emerging space tourism sector taking seriously the possibility of human conception occurring during spaceflight and considering the consequences and mitigation strategies?
You know exactly where my brain went, don't you, Sarah?
What?
River Song. I mean, technically that was in the time vortex and that's why she was a problem. But space! It was still space!
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So it's not just the sex. It's the conception.
It's the conception. And the growth. And maybe even the birth.
Yeah.
Oh.
So it could get quite interesting.
Okay. Okay. So we're not talking about having sex in zero gravity.
I don't think we'll be talking about all the positions you can
Excellent. Go I'm into. I'm not really up for that today. That would take a lot of gin.
No, it would. Yeah. It would. So welcome back, David.
Hi there.
Thank you for joining us for our main episode. We have tasted our moonshot gin and all the possibilities that we could add to it for a cocktail or cooking for later. And now we get on to our main episode. And of course, our topic this week is sex in space.
Which is a brilliant title, may I say. One of my top 10.
It is. But I do have to keep refraining from singing like it's Pigs in Space from the Muppets. So I will refrain. We'll refrain. We're talking sex in space. We've got a question that we're going to try and answer. And as always, Anya and I are going to disclose our wealth of knowledge on the topic first. So our question, Anya, is the emerging space tourism sector taking seriously the possibility of human conception occurring during spaceflight and considering the consequences and mitigation strategies? David, sit back, enjoy your drink.
And listen to us really talk rubbish.
What have you got?
I'm going to make a bold claim, Sarah. I don't think that space tourism is taking anything seriously enough. I'm worried about the whole thing. As somebody who worries about everything, I find the idea of space tourism very scary. So no, I'm going to say they're not. And my wealth of knowledge on this subject is limited. And yet again, I am being my own stereotype to Doctor Who, with River Song being conceived in the time vortex and that giving her weird space powers. So while I don't think that's probably a concern, I can imagine there are concerns about conceiving a child / growing it in space. I mean, how long's your space tourism journey? How long are you going to be? Growing a baby is a terrifying thing anyway.
I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, we've just been through the gin and how it didn't really go into space and that little journey. And you're right that I think the space tourism is like it's taking a flight. And at the moment, it's short enough to you're not going to be bothered about trying to do anything, are you? You know, you're just thinking about not passing out, not being sick.
Speak for yourself, Sarah. Some of us have got one ambition.
Yeah, but there must be, like on a plane, the Mile High Club, you know, that are going to want to go into space tourism.
The thing is about humans, if somebody's going in space, somebody out there is going to go, I'm going to try it, because that's what we do as humans. It's weird.
And we're then talking about, you know, people populating space things. I can't think of the word that I wanted for it.
Space stations? Planets?
That's the one. They're the ones. Stations.
Oh, space and now stations. I'm on the 100 because they were all trapped in things in space. Sorry, I've gone. Absolutely. I'm off topic again. So, shut me down.
So we're thinking about, you know, going up and living on this space station and... I think, you know, the thought is it's just like being in a plane in space for longer. So maybe like being in a metal hotel up in space for longer. So therefore, what is the difference of having sex on Earth to having sex in space? It's just going to happen. And I don't think they're risk assessing anything.
You know, I'd love to see that risk assessment form, though. How do you fill that one out? No. God, there's so many things to consider. David, there can't be any gems of knowledge in there. I don't think that was useful.
We've got no knowledge, but I tell you what, I love this whole question because I have never even thought
never considered
of sex in space. I've never thought of it. Although every time I say that, as well as the pigs in space, I also think of that amazing book by Babette Cole about mummy
ladies and daddies.
And then the whole page spread of all the different positions of
hot
having
air
sex.
Balloon, hot air balloon. On a skateboard.
Skateboards, yeah. All of those.
Attached to normal balloons? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I want Babette Cole to do a sex in space, you know, whole page. But it isn't anything I have ever thought about, ever.
No.
You know, I haven't ever sort of just gone, I wonder if people have sex in space, what would happen? So we're blank slates, David. Yeah. I don't think we've got anything, but we've got much to learn.
Okay, so as you say, what does your kind of conversation add? I think it adds context. In that it's a starting point.
Good.
To then.
There's something there.
As everyone's there going, where are we going to put the bar? Where are we going to put...
On the floor.
Lower.
We're at context.
So you've given us a starting point. So there's almost two views. One is the really, really long-term view. So we're talking about decades, potentially centuries. And the other one is a really, really short-term kind of view, perhaps in the next 10 years.
Oh, so not so short-term, long-term, as in thinking, not in time in space.
No, yes, as in terms of kind of thinking about the consequences of the questions about sex in space. So I think the reason why you came across kind of me was because of work that we published as a group. And I was the lead author, which was looking at a very, very specific question. I think you read the question out more or less at the beginning of this section,
yeah.
Which is talking about space tourism in the short term. And within the paper we published, we talked about the next 10 years. But that ended up getting us talking to an organization called Spaceborne United. That's an advocacy group based in the Netherlands, which is it's looking to advocate the need for humankind now to start thinking about questions about human reproduction off-world if we are going to become, at some point, an interplanetary species. So this organisation is an advocacy group to start thinking about what would be needed for that really long-term, kind of decades away, if not centuries away. So very much following the kind of narrative of people like Elon Musk saying that we need to eventually become an interplanetary species for all kinds of reasons. And Spaceborne United has kind of looked at this and said, well, actually, one of the real showstoppers at the moment is human reproduction, that whole life cycle from conception through to kind of live birth, and then, of course, that transition from a baby through to an adult, and then, of course, adult to kind of end of life, that whole life cycle. There's so many things we don't know about how that whole life cycle would occur if we go into space environments where there are primarily two really important differences. One is that it's likely to be a changed gravity environment. So if you're in space, free fall, or well away from any kind of large body, effectively microgravity, or if we're on the surface of Mars or Moon, reduced gravity. So on the surface of the Moon, 1/6 Earth gravity. On the surface of Mars, roughly 1/3 Earth gravity. So how is that change in gravity going to affect various stages of that whole human life cycle? And then the other one is the exposure to higher levels of ionizing radiation than we typically experience here on the surface of Earth at the moment. And so they are likely to, at the moment, be the showstoppers, not other technological questions. So therefore, they started thinking about that. And so we are involved in a couple of projects involving in thinking of some kind of space engineering aspects of some of this long-term thing. There's still nothing about the really short-term space tourism. And it was in one of those conversations where there was a kind of almost an off-the-cuff statement, which kind of kicked off the whole of the kind of, well, what happened in the short term. And we were talking about when could we expect to see the first human conception in space. And by that, what we meant was something where this is being done with the full approval of Earth society. So basically, it's got all the ethical regulatory kind of approval.
It's not just somebody sneaking off on a sort of travel
They've
flight.
Done
it's,
their risk assessments.
It's a planned conception.
It's gone through kind of well-established committees representing broad societal kind of approval, been approved.
Oh, it's sexy, isn't it? That is so sexy. Oh, it's been risk assessed. It's been approved. Let's go crazy.
and therefore, we say, well, to get the data to allow a committee like that to say, yes, it would be safe, or the risk would be so low that it is acceptable for the benefits to society for having that kind of reproduction in space. We thought that would be decades and decades away before you would ever get the data sets needed to be able to back that up. And I think it was myself in one of the conversations said, yeah, but as soon as you get space tourists in space, you've already mentioned it, the Mile High Club, you're going to have human conception at least human kind of sexual interactions. And we kind of all looked at each other and said, well, yes, but surely the space tourism sector's been thinking about this, haven't they?
I bet they haven't. I can't imagine a world in which you're going up on your space travel flight and a bit like you're on a sort of, you know, standard flight, someone's going your emergency exits here, here and here. If you need a condom, they're at the back. Like, you know, nobody's doing that.
You haven't seen our recommendations, have you, from this world?
Oh, please tell me the recommendations.
I'll leave it towards the end.
I'll make a note. We'll come
hanging.
Back to that.
Let's leave you hanging for a minute. Because we've still got to think about, you know, I'm considering that they wouldn't think about it because all they're thinking about is the logistics of getting tourists into space and back again.
Yeah, it's no small feat.
There's no thinking about what they do. It's just the process of there and back.
Yes and no. Give a little bit more detailed context. So all of the things I'm going to be talking about kind of over the next kind of, how long it's going to be, kind of tens of minutes, we captured together and published about 6 months ago in a paper to highlight that what we see is a gap in thinking and some suggestions as to why there's a gap and some suggestions as what should be done to fill it, to mitigate, to still allow space tourism to occur and develop, but to mitigate or reduce significantly the risks of human conception occurring kind of in those kind of first, say, 10 years. And so we published that.
Not sex. Not allowed to have sex.
Anything has been shown, abstinence education does not work.
So when we've been promoting this, we make very, very clear that in our recommendations, we are definitely not saying there should be no sexual interactions. What we're saying is, and hence the kind of, I'm sure we'll discuss about contraception kind of in a while, that we should minimise the potential for human conception to occur.
There's a difference there.
And this is an example of where, for example, the Daily Star got their news story wrong. Because I appeared on the front page of the Daily Star suggesting that, I think the terminology they use, and it's very difficult for me to pronounce, I was a fun sponge boff. As in, their interpretation was we were trying to suggest that sex should be banned in space, and therefore we were sucking all of the fun out of spaceflight. And of course, I'm a boffin.
Imagine that being the only fun you could have on a spaceflight. I'm sorry, guys. You need to learn how to do other things.
So we put out a press release to go along with the publication of the article. The press release did generate quite a lot of general media interest, as I'm sure you can imagine. Hence, we appeared on the front page of the Daily Star. Even kind of reappeared, not personally, but we were mentioned on one of the American late night TV talk shows.
Oh,
something called Jimmy Kimmel Live.
Jimmy Kimmel, that's a big deal. You should be proud of that one. That's a big deal. Listen, I'm here to talk about the pop culture, so yeah.
some of the US collaborators on this paper were much more impressed with that than they were with the Daily Star.
I can imagine, yeah. I'd be more impressed with that than the Daily Star. The Daily Star.
So it's coming back to what was just mentioned about kind of the more kind of, I suppose, the physical aspects of sexual interactions. That quite a lot of the media outlets were asking or were taking the conversation down that route. But obviously kind of that wasn't the focus of the paper. And so therefore, we didn't discuss it in any of those kind of interviews, because we've not really looked at the details of that. And so therefore, again, in this situation, I'm not going to explore those in any more detail. So I'll allow you to speculate.
There's a whole minefield there. So it's probably best to not even go down that route, because
park
the
that.
Risk assessments, put them to the side.
We may briefly touch upon that when we come back to the contraceptive story at the end.
Okay.
So therefore, the story within this paper is that, yes, when we look then at both what's in the public domain in terms of the space tourism sector, discussing this or being aware of it or highlighting it, nothing. Within the kind of group that kind of authored this paper, there's a number of people who are kind of know people in the space tourism sector, and therefore anecdotally they kind of confirm that that doesn't appear to be anything going on behind the scenes really looking at this risk. As soon as you start taking what we would call space tourists, and these are very different than space that the professional astronauts.
Yeah.
And also different what we would call private astronauts, because you've got to look at the reason why professional astronauts and private astronauts are in space. It's because of career development. It's part of kind of peer groups. There's a kind of expectation that the only reason you're in space is because you adhere to the rules and regulations. So we created an argument as to why, given that there's been about over 500 humans in space to date, why there has been no clear evidence of any sexual interactions among those 500 humans in space.
That's a really good point, because all the people who have gone to space so far have been professionals, have been going for a set reason on a mission. And also, and this is maybe me making assumptions here, but I would imagine the majority of them have been men, and I would imagine the majority of them have been straight men. I'm assuming. I don't know.
I'm not aware. So what we do know is that there are data sets out there which document kind of male-female ratios and things like that. So we know that, as you said, that certainly historically the whole data set, it's dominated by men. Clearly, if you then look into a much shorter time window, kind of around about now, then that gender balance has kind of become kind of not, I don't know whether it's equal, but certainly it's not as kind of extremely biased as it was in the early days of space. I'm not aware of any data sets which has looked at sexuality or sexual preferences. So that I don't know. I'm not aware of that, because one of the things we are interested in is, if we're sending humans into space, what will happen to them? This is really general. And if we look at what I think you've already pointed out, when we look at the data set we have of what happens to humans when we go into space, it's a highly biased data set. First of all, it's male dominated. So there is a much smaller data set as to what will happen to females versus males. There's also a very narrow age range. So most of the astronauts tend to be that kind of mid-career. So in the kind of 30s to kind of late 40s, early 50s. There are always a few outliers, but it's a, and of course, I think all of those would be viewed as fit, healthy humans. So we haven't had a large population of kind of very young, very old people who are not particularly fit going into space. So therefore, we've got this relatively large number of people, 500, but as we already said, there's kind of biases that, who have been into space, where there's no reliable documented evidence of any sexual interactions.
Because why would you? You're not going to put in your professional notes, exactly. Yeah, by the way. Yeah.
But I wonder whether with the introduction of females into going into space, whether there's any disclosure in health tests prior to going into space, like going to a hospital, you know, is there any way you could be or think you could be pregnant?
So what is, I think, clear cut, this is one of the few things which does appear to be relatively clear cut in terms of explicitly having a policy. And this is another thing we highlight in our work, which is how certainly the US-dominated kind of space activities, there is a reluctance at an organisational level to discuss anything to do with human sexuality. And there's all kinds of arguments to that. One of it is because of the NASA-dominated kind of environment, and the fact that NASA, the way it gets its funding is through government, and obviously in a slightly more conservative kind of political context in the US, then there is an unwillingness to explicitly have funds going towards anything to do with kind of sexuality or that kind of research.
But even on a non-sexual level, women in space, obviously, we talk about, you know, even a long-haul flight, your period might be affected by that. So if they're sending women in space for months...
So therefore, the one thing that does appear to be very clear-cut is that pregnancy is an immediate deselection from flight. It's obvious it would be. Mm. I mean, in the same way that pregnancy already in many, many activities on Earth, if you are pregnant or known to be pregnant, you're not allowed to do certain things.
Can't ride a roller coaster. Can't go in a hot tub.
So that is very explicit in that pregnancy is an immediate kind of deselection from flight. And again, if you're a professional astronaut, where your whole career is based upon trying to get into space, therefore you're going to try and not to get pregnant during training leading up to a flight. And therefore, you mentioned about periods. Therefore, again, this is documented that a very significant fraction of female astronauts will take things such as the kind of oral kind of combined oral kind of contraceptive for two reasons. One is to minimise the chance of getting pregnant during training and leading up to flight, because if they do become pregnant, then that's an immediate...
Then they can't go.
They can't fly. Mm. And secondly, it's to simply avoid menstruation during flight, because in the austere environments in space, it is obviously there was increased inconvenience in terms of hygiene and such. Yeah. And so a large fraction of female astronauts voluntarily take oral contraceptive to suppress menstruation and also to avoid getting pregnant leading up to spaceflight. So those are some clear-cut kind of examples. Mm.
And these are all professionals that we're talking about, you know. So like with many other professional careers, the rest of us who go, oh yeah, I'll go and do that, we don't think about anything else.
So therefore, I think there's a relatively good data set to say that the probability of sexual interactions among professional astronauts is very low.
Yeah, very low.
Now, the question is, when you then start saying, right, we're now going to start sending space tourists.
Yeah.
And their motivation for being there
is a completely different thing.
And so we argue that in the paper in terms of, again, at various aspects. And of course, one of the aspects there is the kind of people who are likely to do that are likely to be, in a completely different way than professional astronaut, risk takers, much happier in terms of breaking the rules, much more happy to go against societal norms. And so what we argue is that as soon as you start having what we define as space tourists fly, then we feel that there is a good argument why the probability of sexual interactions increases. And also, if you have sexual interactions, then the probability of human conception increases. But I'm being really careful to separate out sexual interactions from human conception.
Of course.
Because if we say we're not allowed to have sexual interactions, then we would be agreeing with the Daily Star in saying that we're banning suspect sex. But if you look at some of the business models, and this is again where it's a slightly strange situation, because some of the proposed business models in the public domain for space tourism allude to the possibility of sexual interactions, because there's talk of space honeymoons.
Because if you're trying to attract your market, then we're competing with ice hotels, and again,
that was their honeymoon, and that's why Riversong was created.
And because it would be a special thing to do together, then absolutely you would be marketing for that.
One organization which tries to kind of do high-end kind of dating agency
Oh, wow.
Was also kind of alluding to kind of having first date in space. So again,
oh, I was going to say there is a TV program waiting to happen, isn't it?
That
you
really
just put
is.
Them all up
Forget
in space. It's
first
like love
dates.
Space.
No,
instead
because
of
first
love
dates
Island,
is
love
a thing.
Space station.
No, first dates is a thing, Sarah. So you get Fred,
I know,
and you get
Absolutely.
Him to do it in space. It's a real worry.
So therefore, we build up the argument that with space tourists, there is, we feel, a well-argued case as to why there is a significantly increased probability of sexual interactions and therefore an increase in kind of potential human conception. The question then is, what could be the risks of human conception occurring in space?
Because that's the thing, conception and pregnancy within itself has plenty of risk.
Agreed.
If you then add another thing into it, it blows my mind to think about.
And what is that risk curve as well? Because we're talking about the time in space as well. And if you go up for a little jolly in space and you happen to conceive, are there the risks minimal in contrast to being up there for months or years or whatever?
The bottom line is we simply don't know, and therefore that's the risk. It isn't that it's a clearly known risk. If you have sex in space and you conceive, this will be the consequences. We're not at that stage. But what the summary is,
that's
is
an
that
interesting trial it, description, it,
is,
isn't it?
Yeah, is that though we simply don't know. And therefore, that's the issue. The risk is the fact we don't know for certain whether there will be or will not be any increased risks in terms of consuming in space versus kind of on Earth. But to go through the details, and I think we've already mentioned it really early on, there are two key things which we're interested in. One is changed gravity levels. And of course, if you're in orbit around the Earth, we're talking about weightlessness. And the other is increased levels of ionizing radiation. Although for the kind of early space flights over the next kind of 10 years, I think it's the gravity issue that's likely to be the dominant feature. And certainly in the paper, we perhaps emphasize more the gravity effects than the kind of radiation effects.
And can I ask about the gravity? What's the effect of gravity on our internal organs?
Good question.
Okay, so again, we need to think about timescales. So if we put it in the times to keep it in context, if we think about different timescales in terms of space tourism, at the moment, what we would call proper space tourists, they're the people who are going up on kind of Virgin Galactic. They don't go into orbit. They're kind of launched in a space plane or a rocket. They go up to the edge of space. They'll then fly for about...
Like the djinn, but a bit further.
Oh, no. The djinn is not the same. The djinn never goes anywhere near the same.
But a bit further.
A lot further.
Quite a lot.
So the... in fact, you need to go above something called the Kármán lines. The Kármán line is kind of the definition of the edge of space, which is not about 20... some kilometres, it's more like kind of 80 to 100 kilometres up. In fact, we even suggest in the paper that perhaps kind of the equivalent of the Mile High Club should be the Kármán Line Club.
That's quite catchy.
I love you're going to coin Kármán that Club. Here now. There
yeah.
we go.
Put a trademark on that.
That is what it's called.
So at the moment, the things you see on TV, the actual space tours, they only loop up into space for kind of a few minutes, typically about 4 or 5 minutes of exposure to what we call space environments, and then they come back kind of to Earth. Whereas the next phase in the next few years will have people going into orbit around the Earth and therefore will be in space in a weightless environment for perhaps, well, if they do one orbit, typically about 90 minutes, they're likely to do many more. So they'll be there for kind of a couple of days. There's even talk, and there's actually been a rostered flight proposed to fly tourists and loop them around the moon and come back, which will be then again a week or so. So if you're in space for just a kind of few minutes, there will be some changes in terms of weightlessness. But what we're arguing in the paper is that for those really short flights, we think the probability of people engaging in sexual interactions is going to be low. And if even if they do, there is going to be such a short amount of time where the relevant biological steps will be exposed to microgravity. So we don't see that as a particular high risk. We see it when we start going into orbital space flight or space tourism, where people are there for kind of days, multiple days, perhaps up to a couple of weeks. So what happens to the body generally? So if you go into weightlessness over those kind of time periods, one of the things which happens is that you get what's called fluid shifts. So as we're sitting here now, kind of our bodies are full of fluids in various kind of vessels, be they blood vessels or whatever. And of course, you have gravity acting on them. So you tend to have fluids pool to the lower parts of your extremities. When you go into space, you get a redistribution of fluids, which means you tend to have more fluids in your upper body. So astronauts, when you look at them, they tend to have puffy faces. It's a bit like when you're lying down overnight, you're lying flat, and actually you get a redistribution of body fluids because now no longer is gravity pulling it to your feet. So it's redistributing. You get up in the morning, your face is a bit puffy. And that will then disappear in kind of half an hour. And again, that's because of fluid shifts. But in space, you're constantly exposed to that fluid shifts. That can have all kinds of knock-on consequences. And if you're there for kind of a significant time, then your muscles start wasting because you're not using your muscles to support yourself.
Which for child development, that's bonkers to think about.
And so therefore, if you think about going to again to the really, really long term aspects of humans reproducing the full life cycle, you've got to think about how humanity has evolved to grow in a 1G environment. And so therefore, we're influenced by that. If you take that away, then the development of bones and muscles and the whole skeleton will be, it's likely to be very different. But if we then look at if we're now saying that humans, say tourists, are going to be in a microgravity environment for, say, days to a couple of weeks. And if we're saying that they have an increased chance of having sexual interactions and that some of those sexual interactions could result in human conception or fertilization, then the question is, what effect does microgravity have on the kind of those kind of late stages of what's called gametogenesis, and then obviously the fertilization and the early development of the embryo, because all of those steps will happen within about that 14 days. So bringing it back to the way that we're looking at space tourism, which isn't necessarily looking at it from a point of view of the science and such, it's just simply saying that within the space tourism sector, looking at that as a kind of business model, as a system, and remember, I'm coming at this perhaps from a space systems engineering point of view. If we look at the whole system of space tourism, are there any risks that could kind of damage the ability to deliver space tourism? And one of the risks we see is that if this whole system of space tourism doesn't see this as a risk and therefore try and mitigate it, it could be a risk to the development of the space tourism sector, because if human conception was to occur, and that embryo development occurred to a certain level, but then there was problems in terms of then either miscarriage or there was, for example, then taken to term a live birth, but then there was some issues with the child. There is all kinds of issues to do with ethics, with liability, reputational damage that could then, if you stand again back from a kind of systems engineering point of view, that could be a way that then has a very large negative impact on the space tourism business, because basically it may collapse because of reputational damage and litigation and such.
It's a massive concern. And we said we'd go back to the contraception, and I'm wondering from this conversation, as a young woman, so when we talk about contraception, obviously we talk about particular types. Typically we talk about the pill, we talk about the condom, we talk about the injection, we talk about the coil, these sorts of things. In terms of going into space and the effect of gravity on those things, I'm assuming we don't have research on how those might be affected, particularly in terms of things like the coil and the injection and those kinds of things. Is there any research?
No. And so therefore, in terms of some of our conclusions from the kind of these kind of arguments. So obviously one batch of conclusions is to say, look, just simply all of the actors, the stakeholders, the people involved in the space tourism sector, including quite a broad kind of range of people, need to come together and start discussing this to understand what the risks are and to start thinking about risk mitigation strategies and to try and establish some kind of community best practice. So that's one batch. But then coming to the kind of contraceptive kind of argument, so some of the other recommendations we make, what we don't do is to simply say there needs to be more research in terms of human reproduction, because that's, if you go down that route, there's going to be decades before you get any clarity.
Yeah.
So what we're not, because, and that would therefore then kill the kind of space tourism sector. So we're not suggesting that. What we're simply saying is you've got to find ways of reducing to an acceptable level the risks, the risk of conception occurring. And therefore, it's quite obvious that one of the ways that we do that on Earth to reduce, to not stop sexual interactions, we've already argued that certainly we want to, we kind of see that there are some business models which kind of allude to that. And again, obviously, we have the Daily Star kind of issue that. So therefore, on Earth, we clearly use contraception as one way to kind of reduce the probability of conception resulting from sexual interactions. And again, thinking about this really from almost kind of the legal point of view, which is that, yes, we could argue or anecdotally kind of suggest that kind of certain contraceptive techniques should work in microgravity. But there's a difference between that and having something which you can put forward as being, here is some validation of it working. And so that actually our recommendation, one of our key recommendations about contraception, is to say we recommend that the community kind of looks into ways to try and understand how they could validate existing off-the-shelf contraceptive approaches for use in a microgravity environment. Some of those approaches, you could argue that there shouldn't be a difference, but there's a difference between arguing there shouldn't be.
Yeah, I mean, if you're doing a short-term flight and you land and you very recently, your plan B is probably going to be effective. Go crazy. But things like, you know, the injection or the pill, which are quite dependent on your body anyway, and if your body is being slightly messed with when you are in space, that is a potential minefield.
Therefore, what the validation should look like is a recommendation that simply the communities who are more familiar with how these are validated on Earth should look at ways in terms of which they can be validated in space. But we know from other situations, for example, in medicine, that one of the problems with space is that the data sets are always very small in numbers. And therefore, if you've got an existing procedure on Earth, which is you validate it by having a very large population where you kind of do some trials and you kind of you get this large cohort of data. But in space, rather than having kind of potentially thousands of patients in your study, you perhaps only have a few tens of people. Well, no, even a few tens of people is kind of would be fantastic. Kind of a few single people. And so one of the, not just for kind of validating contraceptive, but for other kind of medical situations, how do you validate a particular drug or treatment for use in space where you can't rely upon the normal kind of approaches to kind of get regular approval that you would do on Earth?
Then the other thing is cropping up for me is the pill is only as effective as it is if you take it at the same time every day. If you're in space, again, long haul flights, time zones, do you set a timer for every 24 hours you take it? Like, what's the situation there?
Yeah, and so in my case, I do not know. So obviously that highlights two strands. So one strand is given that we do know that there is a fraction of female astronauts who do use the oral contraceptive to suppress menstruation during flight, is to then go back and look at what happens there in terms of what's the existing practice of using oral contraceptives among existing kind of female astronauts. And then, of course, then the other avenue is to then go down the more kind of drug trials, or just look at the existing workflow that's used on Earth to get regulatory approval for how to use oral contraceptives and such. But as you point out, the other issue is that the body does change in space, so that therefore, again, that is one mechanism where there may be some changes. That means that kind of the effectiveness compared to on Earth kind of reduces, or perhaps actually goes the other way in space. The issue is we don't know. We don't have the data.
Can I also put my really cynical hat on?
Please do. I love when you put your cynical hat on.
You know, because we've been talking about this from a really interested in this whole issue and, you know, how seriously are they even going to want to take this? Or is it easier just to create the legalese document that females have to sign?
And why is it always on the women?
So again, this is another recommendation that we made, which was, what's an example of other types of risk mitigation? So the contraceptive actually perhaps was not our major one. So the major short term is, in fact, I think it's the common sense one. It's the one that you already kind of suggested, which is to simply have two things, which is, as part of the medical counselling that any space tourist has when they go into space, because there are risks just to them as an individual, that includes a compulsory piece of counselling on sexual education and all the risks associated and the unknowns associated with human conception in space, so that therefore people have to kind of go through that counselling and then sign an irrelevant kind of waiver, such that therefore if they then do still go go ahead and result in a human conception, that that kind of other parts of the kind of space tourism kind of sector are not held liable for kind of the consequences of that. And then of course it then again gets quite messy, because you then have that whole aspect of kind of how do you then map that on legal situations here on Earth, which is kind of that of kind of parental kind of fetal harm. So if you stop doing certain things associated with drugs or alcohol, which can affect kind of the child or the kind of embryo, the fetus, then depending upon your legal kind of jurisdictions that you're under, then there's all kinds of issues to do with kind of fetal harm.
My housemate is a qualified solicitor, and you best believe that the moment I get off recording this, I'm going to go to her and I'm going to go, question for you. Somebody comes to you and I'm going to see what she says.
And of course, then the next quick thing is, we've all just simply said, kind of, obviously that varies where you are in terms of legal jurisdiction. What is still not particularly clear is, what is the legal jurisdiction in space?
Well, yeah, because if you want to dump a body international waters, nobody can come after you. If you want to have an inappropriate,
well, they can though now, can't they? Because basically, you've just polluted space, and it's space litter, and you know, we can get you for that.
Yeah, so the whole regulatory and legal framework again needs kind of our recommendation is that needs to be looked into, such that if there is aspects we've been talking about occurring, then again the legal framework in which to kind of consider that is better defined than it is at the moment. And all of this came from a simple conversation or throwaway comment in kind of this early study.
Completely. And can I ask you, is this cascading out and receiving ears of those that are generating the space tourism to be part of that conversation? Or is this more of an academic and they're still focusing on the money-making tourism side?
Ooh, and don't cynical really Sarah's necessarily really want come to be out,
listening
it?
To it?
So all I can do is to kind of come at it from kind of my own personal experience. So obviously we put this into the public domain about 6 months ago. And
now you're here on Gin and Topic discussing it.
And so,
oh, there you go.
And therefore, what has not happened is that we, as in the authors of this paper, there's about eight of us from US, Europe, South America, and South America. What we haven't had are the really obvious stakeholders knocking on our door saying, right, we need to talk.
Yeah.
So that's an observation that we've had. It's not to say that the relevant stakeholders, the big players, haven't, we assume they've seen this, because obviously it got quite a lot of publicity. So we assume they've seen it. And of course, it may be that they are acting upon it, and they have we've already had the impact of them putting in place kind of details.
Or their lawyers have just been really hard at work, including all of the disclaimers in the documents that tourists sign before they
exactly.
go up in space.
But the whole point is it is making everybody aware of it. So then, even the space
absolutely.
Tourists, they are aware of the issues.
Yeah. As long as they read the small print.
It's on them if they don't read the terms and conditions.
So remember the kind of the whole idea of counselling. It's not just the case of here's a bit of paper, read it in detail. It would normally be some kind of face to face kind of series of in depth interviews to make sure that people really are aware. So it could be that we are having the impact. It's just that the kind of relevant people are not putting it into the public domain. We obviously don't know exactly what's going on, but we do know some people in the sector, and we're not confident that that's happening yet. But we are organising a whole series of kind of interviews and kind of seminars with relevant stakeholders to kind of spread the message, to kind of get more understanding of what the current situation is, and to then try and influence kind of people. Kind of with the arguments we've got, because again, obviously what we're trying to do is try and minimise these risks for all the different people involved.
Of course, me and Sarah are likely to be some of the first people to travel into space, and so we have been thoroughly educated today. But Elon Musk, if you are listening...
Yeah, so obviously what we're trying to do now is look to kind of spread this message more, to validate the message, and then to hopefully influence behaviour. So that's the idea going forward.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even as you say, if that is simply for the tourists ourselves to be really thinking about that kind of thing, which, as we said before this, it's not even a question that it even come into our minds, but also space tourism wasn't something on my agenda. So I wouldn't have thought about it. But yeah, wow.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for chatting to us, David. I feel like I've learned so much. My bar is slightly above context now, I hope.
It is, and we're going to test that in a minute as well.
Oh, good.
How many of those little things are propping your bar up off the floor?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's been really interesting. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
I've enjoyed the moonshot gin at the same time, and thinking about that whole tourist, especially, you know, would they be serving moonshot gin in the bar on this honeymoon
trip going
on?
Absolutely, you know? They should. Even if the story is maybe not quite space, but
yeah, you know. Thank you so much, David, for sharing that with us.
Thank
it's
you.
Been really, really interesting.
Thank
and
you.
I think it's going to be a conversation I'm just going to keep having, because it is one of those mind-bending kind of things in terms of, have you ever thought? Mm-hmm. And it could go on forever. Really, really good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anya, sex in space.
Sex in space.
Never thought about it, but Blumenau, they should be. Sex
all
tourism,
I'm
not
is,
sex tourism.
Not sex
space
tourism.
Tourism.
Jesus, Sarah. My overriding thought of all this, though, is lesbianism for the win.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, not in those relational issues, because, as again, you know, the whole it's the female body dealing with and the baby and all blah, blah, blah. I think let's go back. Let's go back. So our question is, the emerging space tourism sector taking seriously the possibility of human conception?
David, my...
Yes.
Well,
yes, when it comes to marketing for honeymoons, and the potential that.
But are they risk assessing it properly? Maybe not, because they haven't got the data to work off in the first place, and they haven't considered it fully in a well-rounded perspective.
Absolutely, because you've got the professionals who go up into the space, into space. Most of them are men. Some of them are women, but they are, you know, professional athletes of space that, you know, they are taking all of the precautions and making sure they're fit and healthy and they are not pregnant.
No.
Tourism, well, from what I've seen of the majority of the marketing, it's like getting a flight.
Yeah.
And I don't think about whether I've had sex or going to have sex or anything like that.
Disgusting. Thank you. Moving on.
Yeah.
But therefore, the jokes we can only make because of our relationship.
But therefore, you're not going to think about it. And if I'm somebody that's going to go up into space, I'm probably a little bit more laissez-faire with my own life and body and, you know,
They're not on your types with a colour-coded planned diary, are they?
No, and if I'm booking it for my honeymoon...
You're probably expecting to do that in space.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, in answer to our question, are they taking it seriously? Probably not as seriously as they should. But do we have the data for them to look at it seriously? Not yet.
That's the difficulty as well. And do the tourists want them to be taking it seriously? Probably not. They just want it to happen. So we don't want to delay to get that data, because how would you get that data?
Let's be real. This all goes back to the age-old saying, wrap it before you tap it. Don't be silly. Cover your willy.
Yeah, but you've got to be careful about what you're actually going to use and whether it's going to work in those conditions.
But we don't have the data to know that yet, Sarah, so that will be an episode in 5 years, 10 years' time.
And you've got to deal with the risk, because even wrapping before you tap it doesn't mean it's going to actually stop anything.
It's true, but whatever you do, Jesus, don't use the pull-out method.
That's a visual of space you don't want to have on your retina, but
and
you
on
have
that
now.
Note, welcome back to Gin Topics Series 6. Here we are. Can't wait to have you.
We started it. We have Series 6. That was the first episode. It was good. I enjoyed the moonshot gin.
I did too.
It's a classic London dry. Can't taste the moon rock. Don't know what moon rock tastes like.
But it's bloody tasty.
But I enjoyed it.
And on that note, see you next week.
See ya.
I'm mind-boggled and I've got an empty glass, and that is Gin and Topic in a nutshell.
Oh, it is. So it was good, and we will fill that glass for next week, and we will empty our brains sieve-like and be ready to learn more next week.
Sarah, before next week, where can everyone find us?
Well, they can find us on social media at Topic Gin, or they can head over to our website at ginandtopic.com, and they can message us, they can, you know, interact with us on that social media type platforming thing. And of course, don't have to wait a whole week.
No.
Because we've got Tuesday Booze Day on Tuesday, introducing the gin. And they can always listen to episodes that they might not have listened to whilst they're waiting.
We've got 6 whole series. You've got 5 to go back and listen to if you haven't already. And we will see you on Tuesday for Tuesday Booze Day.
Nice. Cheers.
Sláinte.